Hi, I'm the Strategist Cowboy. Today I'm going to review two normal ABV Pilsner Lager type beers. One from the state of Bavaria in Germany, and the other one is originally a Japanese brewery, but now it's international. This week's two contestants are the Veldensteiner Premium Pils, and the other one is the Asahi Super Dry.
Let's get ready to rumble!
Our first contestant for this week is the Veldensteiner Premium Pils from the Bavarian brewery Veldensteiner, owned by von Kaiser Brau GmbH and Company. Ownership is a little bit unclear, as often is with particularly mainstream breweries. Veldensteiner is named after a thousand-year-old castle in Nauhaus in Bavaria, in which vicinity I guess the brewery is located. The brewery has been brewing beers since the year 1929. It is a mainstream brewery. The ingredients in the Veldensteiner Premium Pils beer assortment are, accordingly with the Bayerischen Reinheitsgebot, water, barley malt, hop, and hop extract, and yeast. Is the beer really considered to be brewed according to the Bavarian Reinheitsgebot if there is hop extract in it? I don't know. The expiration date on this particular beer is the end of January 2024. I purchased this beer in late December 2022. It has been standing in my cooler since. The Veldensteiner Premium Pils beer assortment comes in a European size 33 centiliters, i.e. about 11 liquid ounces can. The can is mostly dark and golden. There is an image, or rather two images, of a castle on the front on this can, and the same images on the back of the can. It must be the Castle Veldensteiner, I'm thinking. The Veldensteiner Premium Pils beer assortment cost me 15 kronor, i.e. $1.50. That is a mere 54 cents for every 4 ounces of beer. I said it last week and I'll say it again. What can you expect to get for that price? This time, I have no high expectations though. Systembolaget says that the preferred serving temperature on this beer is 8 degrees Celsius, i.e. about 4 to 6 degrees Fahrenheit. The Veldensteiner Premium Pils beer assortment has got a 4.9% ABV, 4.9%. How about the experience then? Oh, it's an okay aroma. And that's good. It's got about a 2 fingers tall head. It's clear in color. Of course, it should be. It's a lager beer. 2 fingers plus tall head. And it's got a nice white foam, a little bubbly. Pilsner lager aroma. Okay, let's see here. It's not cloudy, as I said, perhaps. I don't remember. and the color is yellowish, yellow, very yellow. First impression is... Oh, it's okay. Not very, really strikingly good, but it's not bad. It's a mainstream beer, so for a mainstream beer, it's pretty good. So far, but let's see a little bit later. Is it rich then? Well, yeah, it is pretty rich for a lager beer or a pilsner beer even. I don't think it's bread-like exactly, and it's not yeasty. It's malty. No surprise there. And the taste on my palate is a little bit artificial, actually. Not exactly pine needle taste, but a little bit artificial. Well, pine needle, yeah. But artificial pine needle, what's that? What is that? It's like a little bit artificial and a little bit of pine needle. It's more dry than sweet for sure. I wouldn't say that it's bitter. It's this pine needle taste that makes it similar to bitterness or the artificialness in it. I don't sense the hops in it. It's not candy-like. I don't think it's fruity either. And I don't think it's spicy, but the undertone is artificial, unfortunately. Carbonation level, I don't know it, not yet anyway. It's not creamy. It's not acidic, but there are some aberrations, as I said. Pine needle, that's an aberration in my book. And artificial is definitely an aberration. One moment. Excuse me. It's not dark roasted, of course, and it's a pilsner, so it's filtered. Let's see here if I can find any more. I don't think so, but maybe I can find more flavors. Pine needle already said. Pineapple, no, there's no pineapple in it. No apricot taste. No light bread taste, I think. No banana taste. I don't think it's straw-like. Again, that's the artificial in it. The artificial taste. There's, I don't think it's syrup in it. No, I don't sense any syrup in it, so that's good. There's no honey, no licorice, no clove, no fudge, no chocolate, no coffee, no raspberry, no blueberry, no mango, no tangerine, no raisin, and no vanilla. No, nothing else. It's just, unfortunately, a little bit artificial in taste. Okay, what about grading then? Well, how many divots do I grade this beer? Three devils out of 10 possible. So it's low. It's a low class beer. But it's a mainstream beer. So, but even for a mainstream beer, if I count in them, if I could take them in account, I would still grade this beer three devils out of 10 possible. So I'm sorry, but that's the way it is, Veldensteiner. Okay. Let's move on to our next contestant. Our second contestant for this week is the Asahi Super Dry, or Super Dry Beer Assortment. Super Dry, yeah. I guess it is a super dry beer. The beer assortment contains water, barley malt, cornstarch, maize, rice, hops, and yeast. Okay. The best before date on this particular beer bottle is early July 2023. I purchased this beer in late December 2022. It has been standing in my cooler since. At present date, it is mid-April 2023. The bottle contains 33 centiliters, i.e. about 11 liquid ounces. The three-folded bottle label is mostly silver in color. The bottle design with the label and all very much looks like a bottle of soy sauce. This Asahi Super Dry Beer Assortment costs 18 Swedish kronor, i.e. about $1.80. That is 65 cents per 4 ounces of beer. The preferred serving temperature for the Asahi Super Dry is, according to Systembolaget, 6 to 8 degrees Celsius, i.e. about 43 to 46 degrees Fahrenheit. The Asahi Super Dry beer assortment has got a 5.2% ABV. 5.2%. How about the experience then? Interesting aroma. I don't know if it's good or not. It's yellow orangey in color, but clear, very clear. Two fingers tall head. It's not cloudy, as I said. The aroma is typical Pilsner lager aroma, more Pilsner aroma than lager aroma, actually. First impression. This is one of the big export beer brewers, or breweries. So, that's what it tastes like a large scale export brewery. Yeah. It's not very rich. It's not watery either. It's I wouldn't say bread-like either. It's not yeasty. I don't think so, no. But malty, like most export beers are. Taste on my palate, let's see. A little bit artificial. But less than the former beer. It's not sweet, it's dry. It's really dry. It should be, since it's called super dry. Not very bitter or hoppy. Almost none hoppiness in it. It's not candy-like, no fruitiness, I think. Maybe. No, if it is fruitiness in it, it's artificial. There's no spices that I can sense. This is just a typical Pilsner beer, I think. More or less Pilsner lager. The undertone is, it is Pilsner-like in the undertone. And the carbonation level, I know the former beer's carbonation level was pretty high, and they often are export beers. It's like it was a way to compensate for not so good taste. But I don't know. I don't know about what carbonation level this beer has yet. Or have creaminess? No, of course not. It's not acidic. There's a little bit of aberration in it, but not much. It's not dark roasted, of course. Not dark roasted. It's filtered. As should be, perhaps. Let's see, a pineapple? No. Pine needle? I'd say there is some pine needle taste in it. Plus the aberration of artificial taste. But just a little bit. No apricot, no light bread, I think. Perhaps I wouldn't say light bread. Banana, no. Straw. It's straw-like. I think you can say that it is straw-like. That can be good, and it may not be so good. It depends. I don't think they have syrup in it. No, it's mostly the Danes who have syrup in their beers, their Pilsner beers, to be exact, to jack up the ABV level. And there's no honey in it, no licorice, no clove, I think. Well, excuse me. I can't say that it's got clove taste. Excuse me, you can't really say. There's no fudge like in it, no chocolate, no coffee, no raspberry, no blueberry, no mango, no tangerine, excuse me, no raisin and no vanilla. It's a plain pilsner, but there's a little bit of aberration in it. Okay, what about grading then? I have to grade this beer 4 devils out of 10 possible. It's not the best grading, but it's an export beer, and the former beer got less. So I think I'll settle for that, with that. Absolutely don't drink and operate heavy machines, military or civilian. Drink responsibly or not at all. Don't drink at all if you're underage or pregnant. This week's lesson I call "He Who Has Air Superiority Wins Wars," or what? The Battle of Britain would not have led to an Allied victory on the ground in the long run had the British and Americans not continued the Battle of Britain by bombing German cities, oil industries, and some French infrastructure to rubble. Furthermore, it must be recognized that the British were distinctly strategically defensive during the Battle of Britain, but they won their protracted battle despite that, and precisely because they were strategically defensive, and also tenacious, of course. Despite that the odds were still on the German side initially. At the same time, the British could, thanks to their radar installations by the canal, choose between being either tactically offensive or tactically defensive over their own territory, depending on what they had to face. The RAF had a very dynamic rules of engagement, RAW, and was probably better led than Goering's Luftwaffe. How much the British technological superiority in radio communication had to do with the victory can only be speculated in, but the only ones that had access to two-way radio communication in the German planes at the beginning of the Battle of Britain were the Leader planes. British pilots who were jumped. Note, that's a German pilot term. And survived. Jumped over either England or France if they were shot down and could be put back into service fairly immediately. And this matters a lot when, at least for the Germans, it took a year to train a pilot. The Germans, because of their offensive doctrine, lost their downed pilots, those who survived, to captivity during the Battle of Britain. The Luftwaffe also came to play a defensive role during the Allied bombing campaign against German cities. But the Luftwaffe was at that time too few to win. Even so, the German night fighters functioned until the last months of the war, when what was left of the Air Force was reinforced with the temporarily very successful Messerschmitt ME-262 jets. Although the short period when the ME-262
received its first flying aces is not really how a comparable potential situation on our island of Gotland could take shape. Other than that, the enemy superiority would be massive. However, most ME-262s were shot down on the ground or on their way up into the sky, thanks to Allied air superiority, which allowed Allied fighters to circle over German airfields at all times. However, we have an ocean between the Russian air bases and Gotland. We will not allow enemy aircraft over Gotland, and this can be accomplished by a strong anti-aircraft defense. The air defense is supposed to function like a wall, effective enough to become a psychological factor that prevents Russian planes and helicopters from daring to fly through this firewall. But the fact that the German night fighters worked so well right to the end speaks for the fact that you can achieve results in the air despite not having air supremacy, as long as you have a supplementary anti-aircraft defense, at least at that time, with those platforms, with that technology, with that air defense, and at least during night combat. I'm not so sure that whoever has air supremacy will also win a war on Gotland. By that, I mean air supremacy by air, not by anti-aircraft systems. Anti-aircraft superiority is necessary. Gotland is only 50 kilometers wide at its widest stretch in the west-east direction. If you have no eyes or ears, you are forced to quickly squeeze as much as possible out of the remaining air force before it is passed on to Valhalla. You can do this by going on the offensive against targets that you can scout ocularly or optically, such as warships or vehicle convoys on land. It is conceivable that our adversary during the deploy phase on Gotland use air refueling to obtain a suppressing effect. With fighter and attack aircraft, the Russians can operate over our airspace on the island of Gotland for longer periods with the support of air refueling. We must therefore compensate with a strong anti-aircraft defense so that they do not dare to fly over the island to attack our mechanized units. We should have a permanent air defense on Gotland. The opposite side may have more personnel and or wider runways, apart from more aircraft. How effectively can the opposing side utilize their takeoff and landing capabilities compared to us? I.e., how many planes can we get in the air in time to meet the other side's prepared and aired planes, and vice versa? For the Russians, but also for us, this is important if he intends to attack us with low-flying bombers starting from Luga Airport outside St. Petersburg and landing at the Shkalovsk Field outside of Kaliningrad, or vice versa, since the escort planes then flies almost on the jet's kerosene vapor for landing. The Su-34 has a range of 1,100 kilometers when flying at low altitude. It is uncertain whether they can even carry out a mission mainly at low altitude without air refueling the escort aircraft. They also optimistically expect that the Su-34 has a combat radius of 1,000 plus kilometers. Really? If it approached at a low altitude, with their afterburners roaring in battle, which you have to plan for in dire missions. The standoff instruction regulations have always been prevalent. Thank you and see you later, alligator, at a wild crocodile.